Today's sermon brings to an end a series that we've been doing over the summer on the Ten Commandments, which must mean that we're at the Tenth Commandment, which is, "Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or male or female slave, or ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor." This is, of course, a very politically incorrect list of things that you can own. Certainly by today's standards, we no longer imagine that slaves or wives could be property. But there it is, the 10th commandment. The English word covet is derived ultimately through the French from the Latin word cupere, which means to long for, or to desire deeply. We don't use the word covet very much anymore in our day-to-day language. I think that is because the word covet has a bad rap. It's kind of considered to be a politically incorrect word because it is used in the 10th commandment, and we know it's bad, so we don't touch it. But by erasing the word coveting from our common vocabulary, we think, incorrectly, but we think we have erased the bad thing itself. However, we do use a couple of other words that are very similar in meaning to coveting. Envy, jealousy. These words don't have, especially envy, the same negative connotation that coveting has. But they mean pretty much the same thing. Envy, like coveting, is longing for, desiring something that doesn't belong to you. Only envy is not always directed at things like cars, jewelry, or clothing, or houses. You can also be envious of human qualities, like the honor another person has, or the kindness that another person has, or the success that marks another person's life. You can be envious of these human qualities as well. So take, for example, the case of Jesus and the chief priests and the rulers of Israel, who, as we learn from our text in the translation that Rhiannon read, they were jealous, but in most translations, the chief priests envied Jesus. You see, these leaders of the people, they know that Jesus is good. But Jesus is also a threat to their status, to their pragmatic leadership, to the people's affection for them. The leaders envy Jesus, his star quality. The leaders envy Jesus, his success with the crowds. So the chief priests, they hang on to every word of Jesus. They're like vultures waiting, yearning, churning, burning to take what Jesus has back for themselves, even if it means taking Jesus down while they're at it. So the chief priests, they try to trip Jesus up. Maybe kind of like the press tries to trip up Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. It's easier with Trump, of course, but... Oh, good teacher. Good teacher. Why do your disciples break the Sabbath laws? Good teacher. Is divorce lawful? Let's see him get out of that one. Good teacher, should we pay taxes to Rome? Well, if he says yes, the people will hate him for being a traitor. If he says no, we'll turn him into the Romans and get rid of him. Jesus, by what authority do you do these things? You can't say go. You can't say any of the rulers of the people. They hate him. By whose authority? So you see, hopeless Israelites who live in an enemy-occupied territory with soldiers all about, These hopeless Israelites who have had everything good taken from them in the last generation, they turn to Jesus in droves because Jesus teaches that the good of the kingdom of God can be found already in them. It doesn't depend on all that other stuff. And tax collectors and prostitutes, painfully, slowly, but surely, they give up their bad ways when Jesus challenges them to do so. And their lives are new. And Jesus teaches a path of love and nonviolent resistance that gives even the common people the ability to stand up and be proud, even though their land is occupied by enemy troops. But the leaders of the people cannot stand this. Jesus' vision of the kingdom within means an end to their own petty little kingdoms. It means an end to their power and their perks and their status. And so the leaders bring Jesus to Pilate, hoping that their trumped up charges against Jesus will lead to his execution. Ha! We can have all our stuff back. Pilate, of course, recognizes that the leaders are motivated by envy, not really by theology or anything else. So to get Jesus off the hook, Pilate is offering the people a deal. He suggests a choice. They can either have Jesus good, or they can have Barabbas evil. But the leaders of the people are so envious that we know from the other Gospels, they are so envious of the good that Jesus does that they stoke up the crowd to demand Barabbas' freedom rather than Jesus' freedom. Give us Barabbas and crucify Jesus. And here is the terrible ultimate consequence of envy. Envy makes us strike out at the person who has the good thing in order somehow to deprive that person of its use and pleasure. Envy finds no pleasure in someone else's good, whether that's good stuff or a personal virtue. Envy finds no pleasure in someone else's good if envy cannot have it for himself or herself as well. So the Bible's full of stories about envious people who strike out in this way. Cain kills Abel because Cain envied Abel's rapport with God and the way that his sacrifice was accepted. Joseph, you know, of the many colored coats, Joseph's brothers sell him to the traders as a slave because the brothers envied Jacob's relationship with his father. Daniel, who was in exile with the other Israelites, Daniel's exceptional qualities made the Persian leaders grab him to be one of their administrators, because Daniel knew how to administrate. But this makes the other administrators jealous, and so they hatch a plan to have the lions eat Daniel. The striking out that goes with envy, though, doesn't usually, thankfully, end in murder. But more commonly, envy adds up to this: malignant scowls, petty unkindness, vicious rumors designed to take the person down, smoldering hatreds that just burn you inside, that ruin community. So, for example, you know the story of the prodigal son coming back to his father. Well, we read that the angels in heaven even partied on account of the repentance of the prodigal son. Everybody, no, not everybody, is happy. The brother will not join in with the party. But he scowls and he stews and he storms off by himself instead. He envies his brother and his father's magnanimous ability to forgive. And it tears the family apart. Fairy tales also touch on envy and the way that it strikes out at others. So for example, there's the fairy tale of Cinderella. She's a matchless beauty. She has a precious heart, a good spirit. Her ugly stepmother and stepsisters, however, envy Cinderella, her beauty, and her spirit. And what the stepmother and the stepsisters do then is they strike out at Cinderella. They work her to death, and they hide her from the world, and they don't let her attend the ball. Again, this is the ugliness of envy. It cannot stand it when someone else has something good, beautiful, or virtuous. Envy makes us strike out at the person who has the good thing in order somehow to deprive that person of its use or pleasure. Envy's ugly because it destroys, as the stepmother sought to destroy Cinderella, or as the chief priest sought to destroy Jesus. But you know, there's really another interesting reason why envy is ugly. You see, unlike many other sins, envy never feels good. Some sins feel great. Pride offers a moment of self-satisfaction. You get that. Or gluttony, a contented burp, you know. Envy, though, never gives any satisfaction. It's dull and gnawing. It's a thud, thud sort of deadly sin that takes away our pleasure for even the simple things that are best in our lives. So life, if you're an envious person, life becomes dull and gray because the envious person cannot appreciate what is unique and wonderful about others. Envy cannot admire, it cannot respect, it cannot give thanks for what is nobler or lovelier or greater than itself. A life full of envy is just one gray sidewalk slab after another. In the end, envy is named as one of the traditional seven deadly sins because it saps life of joy and leaves only this hulk of emptiness behind it. Envy robs us of the great good that the 10th commandment is trying to protect. And that great good is contentment. And rather than give you a systematic theology of contentment, let me tell you a story. It's like this. Once upon a time, there lived a cobbler who was a happy and contented man. People who passed the cobbler's shop, they always laughed and smiled to hear the cobbler singing at the top of his voice as he hammered away at the shoes that he was fixing. And many people thereby stopped at his shop to bask in the warmth of his smile and to have a good word with him because he always left them happier than when they came. One of the people who observed the cobbler was, I say this with no prejudice, one of the people who observed the cobbler was a banker who sang little and smiled less. The banker seldom slept well. At first he was irritated by the constant good humor of the cobbler whenever he walked by, but as the days passed, the banker became more and more attracted to the cobbler and the cobbler's secret for joy. So finally he decided that he would visit the cobbler and try to discover the secret of the cobbler's happiness. After the two men talked for a while, the banker asked him, So, are you wealthy? Pardon me for asking, but how much money do you make each year?
And the cobbler answers, "Well, most days my family has enough. Some days, though, I only fix shoes and nobody buys new or pays me. Yeah, and the shop is closed on Sundays and all the holy days, and then there's no income at all, especially when we celebrate Christmas or Easter. Still, we manage well enough. But I'm sorry, I cannot tell you how much money I make each year. I really don't know. I've never added it up." "Oh, how wonderfully simple," says the banker. "So, I have decided to eliminate all your financial problems and worries for the immediate future, since you have openly shared your story with me. Take this gift," says the banker, "of 300 gold coins and use them however you need them." Well, overjoyed, the cobbler quickly goes home and he buries the gold in the corner of his kitchen. And the succeeding days bring many changes to his life. He often leaves the shop early, especially when the family is absent, thinking that maybe somebody would come by the house when they were gone and steal his wealth. Then the cobbler begins to lose sleep at night because he fears that people in the neighborhood might be plotting to steal his gold. Old friends notice that he did not sing with the same cheer, and he often seemed suspicious of them when they came to the shop to talk to him, because he thought perhaps they had ulterior motives now. The cobbler was neither happy nor contented. But he was wise enough to see this in himself. And so after thinking it through carefully, the cobbler visited the banker with the bag of gold in his hands. And he said, "Thank you. Thank you for this very generous gift. But I cannot really afford to be the owner of all these gold coins. Please take your money back so that I may again enjoy my music and my sleep and my friends. It seems that when I took your money, you unwittingly took my contentment at the same time. Do not covet your neighbor's good name, or your neighbor's wealth, your neighbor's beauty, or spirituality, or success. Covet these kinds of things, and you are bound to strike out eventually and hurt someone, if only yourself and your peace, in order to achieve or get what you covet. Instead, if you have enough, and most of us do, if you have enough, practice contentment, the spiritual discipline of giving thanks for what you have, while refusing to spend your life trying to acquire what others have already achieved."